Do you love critical care? All right, fine. Are you forced to do critical care for your work? If any of this applies to you and this podcast is of interest to you, then I bet you will also be interested in Brian and my other project, the Intensive Care Academy. That's over at ICU101.com. It is a video-based, self-paced learning platform where you can watch all kinds of videos on all kinds of critical care topics by Brian and myself, walking you through all sorts of things from basic fundamentals of the ICU for new providers, such as the new APP getting in there, the learner, the student, the nurse, all the way up to much more advanced topics. We just got finished with our airway series, culminating in cricothyrotomy, where you can watch me incise my wife's neck. Not really. But I think you guys will like it, and you should check it out if you have not. ICU101.com. Let's get to the show. Everyone, I'm Brandon Odo.
And I'm Brian Bowling.
And this is Critical Care Scenarios, the podcast where we use clinical cases, narrative storytelling, and expert guests to unpack how critical care is practiced in the real world.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the podcast. Brian Bowling with you as usual. And as always, my partner in crime, Brandon Odo, is here.
Milu.
We are going to talk about a topic today that I would venture to say most of you have very little understanding of. even those of us who work in neurocritical care don't really get this that much, I guess.
It's a black box.
Even a lot of my neurologists still say, well, let's see what the epileptologist thinks. And what I know is flat lines are bad, squiggly lines are good. Repeating rhythmic patterns, not so great.
Not too squiggly. It's like an EKG, right?
There's
like
if it looks like an EKG, that's bad. So, if you haven't figured out what we're talking about, your people are listening. They're like, "What is the topic today?" We're talking about EEGs. We talk a lot about EKGs or ECGs in critical care. Not so much about EEGs. So, Brandon and I thought, well, we could probably just do a rundown and encompass all that we know about EEGs, but
speak for yourself.
It would be done, but we'd be done by now. I've literally given you all my knowledge in the intro. So we thought we'd better get somebody who actually knows what they're talking about. So so we have Carolina Maciel with us today, and she's actually perfect for this because she's triple boarded in neurology and neurocritical care and critical care EEG, which I didn't even realize was a thing that you could be boarded in, but that's great. And basically, if it's related to EEG, she knows all about it. So we're going to have her on and help us learn a little bit today.
Thank you for having me. And by like all means, I do not know everything. And who knows everything about the brain? That's the beauty about it, right? You can know a little bit and then people think you're a god of EEG or the brain because you just happen to be interested in having a conversation with the brain. And it's really hard to do that without really listening to the squiggles, not looking at the squiggles. That's very important.
I think it depends on the brain. My brain is not that hard to know everything about. It's some of them are like an orchestra. Some of them are like chopsticks. But.
Oh my God, I just love this. Exactly. So that is the perfect segue, right? The EEG is really the symphony. Oh, no, Brandon, this was just so perfection, right? Because then it's literally what it is. You really can listen to the symphony of the brain. And it is like an orchestra, right? So then the richer the orchestra, the symphony, you know that the healthier the brain is, but it is all within tune and within the rhythm, right? So then when you actually have what Brian just mentioned, whatever repetitive, whatever that it is happening rhythmic or not, and then rhythmic is actually a specific word that we use in EEG meaning different things, but then it disrupts the symphony. You have like a set of little bastards that are just not respecting what it is to be the symphony. So yes, it is just like an orchestra.
Let me just tell you briefly about a patient who could be found in any ICU in this country at this very moment. Let's say there's a 75-year-old female. She's diabetic, hypertensive, also has alcohol-related cirrhosis. Was admitted to the floors on the hospital for what they thought was a community-acquired pneumonia. This was a day or two ago. But then she has a rapid response called because she's more hypoxic, hypotensive, more obtunded, altered mental status. When the team gets there, she's really, it seems like, mostly unresponsive. This is a story you hear, at least. Some people think she has, like, a little sort of generalized twitching. Depends who you ask. Nothing very specific. Anyway, she gets put on some pressors, gets intubated partly for her hypoxia and also for her mental status. Comes off to the, let's say, medical ICU. Chest x-ray shows worsening opacities. They think this is just pneumonia. And the suspicion for the mental status is really just for a kind of general toxic metabolic encephalopathy. But there is a question raised, could there be seizure activity, both just because she is so altered, and maybe there's this twitching business. But now she's on the ventilator, she's sedated, it's even harder to answer the question. So just to start as a general question, for the ICU patient who, let's say, is not even necessarily there for a primarily neurologic problem, although I'm sure this applies to many of them as well, who has altered mental status without really overt seizure features. And I guess I'll include there the person who has some kind of vague movement things, because we have a lot of twitchy patients in general. For that person, how high yield is it to do an EEG? And in my mind, this ends up in the same camp as the, like, non-contrast head CT. We do them a lot, and I think it probably is important for some of them. I mean, there are some important diagnoses you want to catch, but most of them don't say anything. So, I mean, how would you characterize the value of this? Are you going to say, this is not useful, don't do it, or always do it sometimes, or I'm sure there's some gray area here?
Well, let me tell you what is not useful, a short EEG in this setting. You know, like, you're going to get most often than not 20 minutes to 30 minutes recording, depending on the institution, what it is, the short EEG. And with that, you're assuming, like, so if someone is truly unresponsive, you're assuming that actually the neurological status is, it's coming close to true coma, right, when you have reflex-only responses. So the manifestation of the neurological function that you can pick it up, it's very scarce. You do not have much information to work with in figuring it out. Am I on danger zone, or this is the bread and butter altered mental status that you're talking about, acute encephalopathy in the setting of a bunch of systemic derangements, right? And then, is this going worse or getting better, or is this just the nadir of the sick brain just recrudescing from all the systemic derangements? So, and then with the short EEG, it's going to be really hard to tease this apart, because you can't even characterize whatever it is that recording showing, if this there's like state changes present or not, that frequency that you are seeing, is this the quiet, is this the best that this brain can actually produce? And arousals can actually evolve, and then you are left without knowing, do I call this a seizure or not? And I, the way that I teach it, the readers, and that is the distinction, and going back to Brian, when you're saying, like, oh, ICU EEG is a thing versus epilepsy. And yes, it is a thing, because it goes beyond seizures versus not seizures. And the reading of a EEG, or the impression of the EEG, is, it's lethal. It can be lethal. You know, it can lead to a lot of iatrogenesis. So the yield of that EEG, it will really depend on what it is, the question that you want to answer. And it goes way beyond, if you're looking at that EEG, answering more than, is this seizure versus not seizures? So let me ask you a few more things in that particular case, and then I will give you some examples how it can actually be helpful, right? Well, but coming with from the premise that we established that a short EEG is not going to be as of high yield as a longer recording, and I'm not really telling you 24, 48, 72. You need longer enough to capture arousals or stimulation, and then a little bit more in terms of artifact if there are other machines in the room and you need to ascertain that.
Because we know that this person has, you know, other factors, metabolic reasons for having a sort of suppressed EEG, they're sedated, they're sick for other reasons. But if we have a second question, such as are they also having seizure activity, it's just harder to answer because of those. It's like we've turned the volume down on everything. So we just need more data to get that. And a really quick EEG might just be like, I don't know, I need more.
Right. And a sick brain does not seize like those absolutely gorgeous, well-developed seizures in the EMU. EMU is Epilepsy Monitor Unit. Someone that is completely normal, except that it has a lower threshold for seizures, hence epilepsy diagnosis, and they have some spells, and they go into the EMU and get monitored. Then you have a beautiful background. It's obvious that it is the patient is awake or not, or asleep or not, and then you have the seizures. A sick brain, like you described, to the point of being unresponsive because of, I don't know, a cheap pneumonia, and then it gets a little bit decompensated and need more respiratory support, but then ends up unresponsive. That is a very sick brain, right? And then even those brains producing a seizure, the seizure is not as well developed. It's hard to tease apart seizure, ictal activity from actually some abnormal arousal or abnormal changing state. Does that make sense? So you need a little bit more information. Now, I have a few questions for you on your case, right? So you said alcohol use disorder maybe, or just cirrhosis.
Yeah,
I don't know the etiology.
Yeah, known to be cirrhotic.
Known to be cirrhotic. We do not know the etiology. Here, it could potentially help because with the chronic exposure to toxins, you expect that this brain also has a very low reserve. So it doesn't take much to decompensate this brain, and it looks like, you know, clinically like awful, like unresponsive. I'm really holding my
So asking, here. Like, if this patient, just from the perspective of pretest probability, may seem especially susceptible to having seizures may be helpful. Okay, I mean, anyone can have anything in the ICU, but coming in, some people are higher risk.
That's right. It's any atrophic brain, like dementia. Why dementia patients, right? Like the patients that are with some dysphagia and then they end up having a pneumonia, end up landing in your ICU, they are more likely to have seizures because dementia patients are more likely to have seizures. Why? Because this is a brain that's been scarred, right? So a brain that has been exposed to chronic toxins like alcohol use disorder to the point of actually liver failure or cirrhosis, you are by definition having a lower threshold for having seizures. And when you provoke in the setting of sepsis is also another known common etiology or at least risk factor for you to have non-convulsive seizures. And then another question that I have for you is like, what kind of medications are you treating this patient with, right? Like, we give cefepime like candy. And cefepime neurotoxicity is real. We can spend a whole hour here debating what to do with it, right? But then the yield of that EEG for the detection of rhythmic and periodic patterns, particularly the typically seen with cefepime neurotoxicity, is going to be a high yield. And you could argue with me that then is going to be a good one for a short EEG, because you can capture this in the reactive state really quick. And then the other question is that, is your cirrhosis decompensated or not? And then, Brandon, we get into really exciting territory, because that EEG, if you are dealing with someone that it is decompensated cirrhosis, hepatorenal failure, you're about to start RRT, and then that EEG can function as telemetry for detection of the osmotic shifts that happen with the initiation of dialysis in the setting of a high risk for cerebral edema from rapid clearance of osms in cirrhotic patients, particularly when the ammonia is super high and you're using RRT at high flow. So I would say much more exciting than the cheap seizures that you can see as non-convulsive that you can treat, because now it is an opportunity to use the EEG to really save someone from herniation.
Let me ask you about, because, I mean, you've mentioned already a few diagnoses we can make with the EEG, which are not seizure or seizure adjacent, but in the real world, and a lot of my practice has been in not the largest centers, I have very rarely, if ever, seen somebody read an EEG and say anything about it other than there is or is not epileptic activity. So do you think these sorts of things are really being widely looked for and called and diagnosed in the kind of general setting, meaning in the community and in most centers people are practicing in? Is it pretty specialized stuff, like that I really only hear about in conferences and on this podcast? Or where are we at in terms of like translation of these sorts of things?
It is so disheartening to really acknowledge that, no, you know, what the yield that you're getting for what you are paying for a 24 hours EEG is unfortunately, most commonly than not, very low, right? What you get is a bunch of cryptic words and the impression, no seizures. But then there's a bunch of stuff, right? And then particularly when they use the icto intricto continuum, but then no seizures. And you're like, what am I supposed to do with this, right? So yeah, unfortunately, no. But at the same time, we do not have, I think we have about 3, at a maximum 4, critical care EEG formal tracks of training in the country, right? And the lens through which one gets trained with critical care encephalography, it's very different than epilepsy. It goes really beyond seizures versus not seizures. It goes in using EEG as a bedside monitoring tool for with great temporal resolution and somewhat decent spatial resolution for focal abnormalities, for ischemia detection. And then I think most importantly, alarm systems for attenuation and herniation in something that can be reversible, right? So then I think we are not, it's a technology that it has been around for over 100 years. And what we are using or what you're getting out of it, it's much lower than what it could be. And I dare to say that a lot of it is the human factor, right? Now we have quantitative EEGs with trends that are informing us so much more than what the naked eye can actually see by playing the EEG. And then that information, the rich information that it is in your display as an EEG reader, gets lost in translation when you are writing the report for your consumer. And when I teach the fellows on this, is that like, I am a little bit intense. So I say, like, you wake up at 4 in the fucking morning and then read all those EEGs. And before rounds, you got to have a read in. Because people are making decisions, do I extubate or not? Is this encephalopathy, degree of encephalopathy, better or worse than yesterday? And it cannot be that the reader just changed, right? Like, you need to be internally consistent and also inter-reader consistent with basic stuff to really guide the bedside decisions. You're not reading for yourself. You're reading for someone else. So the timeliness with which your reads actually are answering the questions that your clinician wants to know, it's crucial. And you got to talk to the clinician to really know what it is, Brandon, that you want to know in this patient. What are you concerned about? You know, is this just, do you want to just see the marker of cefepime toxicity to see if you really want to switch to meropenem? Is it worth it to really broaden up the coverage just because of how encephalopathic this patient is? Or do you actually care about the 2 leads short seizures that is happening that I don't even know if I should do something about it?
Okay, so depending on, you know, where you are, who you're working with, you may or may not be getting the most thoughtful, deeper impressions of your EEG reads. It would help certainly to speak with the person reading it if you have specific questions. And I would imagine that in some cases, this additional layer of deep thoughts might be coming from your neurology consultants, or ideally a neurointensivist who, I don't know, maybe you could tell me, how comfortable would you say most general neurologists are looking at an EEG? Or perhaps maybe the stopgap is they look at the interpretation and they can conclude something from the findings in it, even if it didn't, you know, reach the impression of the reader. In other words, it means something to them that you have like quaternary inverse squiggles in lead 92 or whatever.
Well, I mean, it really depends, right? If you have a movement disorder specialist that happen to be on consult service in case that your ICU consults are staffed by general neurology as opposed to neurointensivists, you're going to have different answer than you're going to have from someone that actually is more aligned with what could be going on in an ICU patient with sepsis, with all those things, and putting together a much more comprehensive picture that is reflective of what you should worry about in that particular case versus being a little bit behind. So I guess it would depend on your neurologist. I think I cannot think of a neurology residency that you're not going to get some exposure to EEG. But if we accept the premise that even epilepsy-trained neurologists have a different way of looking at the EEG and answering those questions, then I think you already have your answer, right? So it makes a difference to read those EEGs through the lens of critical care encephalography, as opposed to the same lens that you look at those recordings that you have on spell characterization in the EMU. And it is on us, critical care community, to really demand a little bit more. Because if there's no demand, right, then you know, what I am doing is just as fine. I can claim that, you know, I was unaware that it was not meeting your demands, Brandon. So then critical care needs to push. Okay, what else? You know, like, you're giving me a read at 6 p.m. when the patient was disconnected at 6 p.m. last night. You know, that's not doable. That's not doable. And then claim, I don't know, create good trouble.
Okay. So I, as the bedside ICU clinician, have decided we do need an EEG of some kind. I'm going to go to order one. I have to decide what to order now. And many places may have like a variety of things to order, but a lot of what it usually comes down to is how long. So we talked a little bit about, in this setting, probably longer is going to be better than shorter. But what does that mean? I think most places you end up in kind of two categories, one being a, quote, continuous EEG, which is going to be for a day, multiple days, or a kind of routine or spot EEG, which, I don't know, I've seen as short as half an hour and as long as maybe 2 to 4 hours. And sometimes, I mean, what is a 5-hour EEG? I don't know, somewhere in between. So how do you think about these, and when would you say they are indicated?
Things are changing, and what it is, the definition is now surprise based on billing, right? So short EEG is going to be anything less than 2 hours as of now-ish, okay? Like, this, things keep changing, right? So just know that if you are with an EEG for more than 2 hours, it's going to cost way more than a shorter EEG, so why stop at 4,
so
right?
Once you hit 2 hours, you're paying more for it?
It is long. Okay. It is long.
But 4 is the same as 2.
4 is the same as 2. 6 is the same as 2, right? And then it only, when it crosses 12, then you are on the maximum price, okay, if you will.
So there's 3. Okay? There's short, long, and long, long.
Right. But then the difference between the 2 to 12 and the over 12 to 24 hours plus 2 is it's very little. So if you're already going on for, you know, say 10, you know, might as well to just get more information.
Now, you may have a finite number of machines and techs.
That is true. Oh, this is brilliant. So then you can actually, there are some scores out there, and then the two helps to be a score is something that has been validated now, not only in the non-neurocritically ill patient population, so it's a helpful score to know. In our institution, we do have that with the seizure risk and the yield of additional monitoring in terms of percentage to capture seizures, okay? This is used for seizures detection only. So then you have that score that allows you to make this decision. It said, did I capture all or not? And again, it is this score. It needs to be, like, right? We need to critically interpret that this score was based on a population base. You know, like, are you dealing with a patient that it is relatively low risk for history or not, right? So you need to actually really interpret this in the setting that of the patient that you are taking care of. But then you have a difference in a yield of monitoring based on hours and based on what were the findings that you already have in that let's just say, preliminary monitoring session. So if you start having epileptiform discharges or repetitive discharges, and at which frequency of those repetitive discharges, so 2 hertz is kind of a danger zone when arbitrarily we have decided that greater than 2.5 hertz of whatever it is, it's going to be a seizure. If it is surpassing 2.5 hertz, so at 2 hertz, you're like, where are you going with this, brain? You know? And then some rhythmic or periodic patterns that are associated with a higher risk of seizures, like the PDs, periodic discharges, or rhythmic delta activity of the focal subtype, not the GERDA, right? The GR, I cannot say other than GERDA, I cannot spell. I can spell in Portuguese. No. So GERDA, generalized rhythmic delta activity. So that, no study has been able to associate that with seizures. So when your GERDA land, if it looks weird, we're like, oh, whatever, you're just encephalopathic. But all the other patterns, particularly if they are speeding up, then you are a little bit more concerned. So your yield of monitoring for capturing seizures increases if you have on the preliminary read some of those findings.
So in a case like this, you would probably do something like start with a medium length study, a few hours, and then,
for the love of God, do not order a short EEG.
In any ICU patient.
That's what I am saying. Okay. Yes, particularly if you are on sedation, right? And then it is completely useless and you want to capture as you are coming off of sedation or you are weaning like propofol or whatnot. And then you want to see what it is emerging.
Okay, so a few hours and then use the findings to inform whether you might want to go longer, like continuous.
Precisely. Like, am I making any changes, right? Am I going to lift any anesthetic that has anti-seizure properties or not? Or am I starting dialysis and this ammonia is actually 400 or, you know, going and counting, right? So then my sodium is started off with 153 and my dialysate on CBVH is 140. So what's that going to look like when I actually bring those osms down quickly in this decompensated cirrhosis? You know what I'm saying? So then you are actually, again, you need to expand your thought process on, it's not the yield of monitoring just for seizure detection, but do I anticipate any, like, am I going to poke this bear or not? And the bear being the brain.
Right. It's not just what did we see on it. It's, do you expect some things to change that you will want to see?
Okay. That's right.
And
that's
so right. The sedation issue is a good one because I think a lot of the bedside folks are not sure what you want from our end. If we're going to go do an EEG in a patient like this, or perhaps even somebody with higher suspicion, like people really thought they witnessed a seizure, they get intubated, whatever. If they're on the ventilator, most likely they're in most centers on some sort of sedation. What do you want us to do with it? I mean, do you want us to hold it to get you, quote, the best EEG? Do you want to see them on it and off it? What's kind of a routine approach we should use?
Brandon, I want to know what you want to do. And then we are going to decide on the EEG together. No, seriously, because obviously, right, we wanted to have the cleanest EEG possible in terms of, and then it depends, right? What is the cleanest EEG possible? You're having twitches. You do not know. Let's just say that this patient that you had, it turns out that the airway was not amazing and you had a peri-intubation arrest. Right? And it was quick. And now they are, you know, having myoclonic jerks, right? They are twitching in a different way. Now it is obviously myoclonus. You just, you know, whisper in her ear, in their ears, and they are just like all, you know, having generalized myoclonus. Is this subcortical myoclonus post anoxia, meaning subcortical by definition, you know, not a seizure? Or is this cortical myoclonus, is this myoclonic status epilepticus or not? I will not be able to tell you without you maybe giving a paralytic so I can actually clear up the the myogenic artifact and then really try to tease apart what it is the underlying waveform associated with that or not, right? So what do we want? It depends on what's going on in front of us. But rule of thumb, I guess that's where you're getting at. Rule of thumb is that ideally, in order to risk stratify seizures, you want to come off of propofol and midazolam. So is it reasonable to transition this person to dexmedetomidine instead if you still, you know, need some sort of analgesic sedation that allows them to not self-extubate? Okay, maybe that is a good thing while you are monitoring. If you can't do that because you really need to ensure whatever it is that you need for vent synchrony, then I need to work with you, right? So then we'll just monitor a little longer and see what's going on. If you are coming off of cefepime and you want to see something, then, you know, whatever it is that you're going to do, and we are going to just monitor with you. So I guess it is very case dependent. Right. And
so if the question is, what are they doing off sedation, then it's hard to know if they're on sedation. Sometimes that's not the question. Sometimes the question is, what are they doing right now on sedation, such as
that's
if you're monitoring
right.
for like a status patient and you want to know how much you've suppressed them or something. Then obviously, not only is it not safe to take them off, but I mean, the question is, where are we at right now? And then that's a different...
That's right. That's right. And then they may be fine with all this combination. And then what do you foresee? What do you anticipate as the next phase for that patient? Are you approaching liberation? If that's the case, then I would just wait until you come off of it. But when the liberation is not even in the clear horizon, maybe that is a patient that has 6 hours of clean nothingness, right? And you are not anticipating needing the EEG for non-seizure detection, right? For some other event, then you don't need to keep it any longer. And then you can be more cost effective in that setting.
Okay. Now, what about the third category here? And this comes up much more in certain centers, and particularly those with fewer resources. We do have some bedside partial EEG devices that we can apply kind of by the bedside team, like the nurses or the ICU providers, which provides some data on the brain, although it's not a full montage. What do you see as the role of these devices? Because they're really widely used in some places. I know not in others. And I think they have suffered some indication creep in some of those, which is to say that if it's all you have and that's what you use for every EEG. But
That's right. They absolutely have a place. We cannot just make recommendations sitting on the ivory tower when I have 24/7, access to long-term monitoring, and the technicians can go to DED to connect the patient as soon as possible, right? So that's not a reality. And I'm not so sure that needs to be the reality everywhere, honestly. We think we need to be a little bit more cost-effective medicine overall and stop practicing like there are unlimited resources. But in the setting that you will, like knowing right now that this patient is having non-convulsive seizures, right? Because if it is convulsive seizures, you're just going to do what you got to do, yeah? So knowing right now that this patient is having non-convulsive seizures, and you suspect that this is not focal, because very rarely those, like the rapid EEG devices that are usually limited montage, right? So they are headbands. So they are good at picking up generalized stuff. They're really good. I can see that for like cardiac arrest, post-cardiac arrest status epilepticus. They are most often than not very frontally predominant and oftentimes broadly distributed. So generalized is a good word for it. So it's easy to pick it up on those devices. But very focal seizures, you're not really going to be able to pick that up. So you really need to think about what it is that you're using for. Using for brain telemetry as attenuation of cerebral rhythms in a patient that you're going to start RRT urgently, that could be helpful because, again, what you are looking for is something big. It is going to, as Brian said, when it is flat, it's not good. Yeah, so if it's getting flat, then this is something that you could work right there and then give 23%, and then do something about it. I would say if you're thinking that you're going to be dealing with a neurological complication, that it is time sensitive, and we can argue whether or not detection and management of non-convulsive seizures is something that it is time sensitive. I'm going to be grilled to continue with this line of thought from the neurological side. But then you know, if you're thinking they're dealing with a time-sensitive neurological complication, and usually non-convulsive, then and you don't have access to something that can give you much more information than seizures, non-seizures, then, you know, they absolutely have a role.
Well, and the question of, you know, partial or focal seizures versus general one, I think is also relevant here, because a lot of the patients like I described, you know, let's say before she was intubated, she was on the floor, she's sort of sick, you know, very obtunded. That's how we got down this road. But, you know, maybe you stimulate her and she groans and does something. She's clearly somewhat responsive. That person is not having generalized seizures.
Nope.
So
nope.
The question already is about
actually they
partial.
May.
Oh, okay.
Nope. Don't go there. They may. That is the beauty. We know nothing about the brain, man. We really don't. They may. And Amy, that's why. I mean, they are grunting that it is a response. That's not necessarily the best possible response that person can have. You know, it's so funny. Every time that I go staff the neuro ICU, and it is this ridiculous right hemispheric stroke, right? It's awful. The insula, it's like, oh, you know? And then I said, okay, I do not see, we are day five. I do not see this patient, like any G. Oh, they're following commands. Oh, come on. You know, they're language dominant on the left side. Of course, they're going to follow commands. And they are still maybe seizing from the right side, which will be, not necessarily, like with inability to follow commands. So there is nothing reassuring enough clinically that can tell you with absolute certainty that that person is not having non-convulsive seizures.
Because okay. We used to say a generalized seizure involves your whole brain, so it must
bullshit.
Make you insensate.
Bullshit.
So
bullshit. Well, okay, so rule of thumb for neurology teaching: to impair consciousness, you need to have a bihemispheric thing or diencephalic or brainstem. Well, guess what? Not everybody reads the book.
I was going to say, one thing I have learned in practicing neurocritical care for the last 10 years or so is that anything can be a seizure.
Right. Pretty much.
I've one thing that I like about, you know, in my job, I go back and forth between the SICU and the neuro ICU. And it's fun on the SICU to service, to run into neurologic stuff and understand them. And everybody thinks you're a genius. But I've caught more than one patient having non-convulsive status epilepticus just because their gaze is deviated weird or, you know. So.
Right. And then the other thing, like I have a little anecdote, I promise it's not going to take long. So, you know, when you were at the peak of your Dunning-Kruger curve, right? Like I did EEG after I did neurocritical care. So I was a neurointensivist, right? Reading EEG. Oh, I thought I knew it all. So then I had to rotate with the epileptologist on the EMU. And it was a very prolific service in terms of surgery, surgical epilepsy. So they would implant. It was like brilliant. They would implant intracranially, like wrap the brain around with leads, with strips, and it was absolutely gorgeous. And then I was meeting this patient whose description of spells were punching someone in the face or kissing them. It's unpredictable which one it would be. And then I'm like, oh, hey, yeah, right. Intracranially, those were seizures. And actually, I remember when she was implanted, her surgeon came to examine her, and she just grabbed him. And I was like, oh, my God, is it going to be the kiss or is it going to be the punch? You know, and I was like, pay attention to the video and not the EEG, you know, because I was so enthusiastic with what it would be. And end up being a kiss. And it was like obvious, like very well developed frontal seizures. So the brain is cool, you know?
I might be seizing right now.
And yeah. Capricious. I think that's what it is. Anything can be a seizure. I agree, Brian, even kissing and punching. But, you know, maybe not in the ICU, I guess.
I don't know.
Maybe you will, actually.
Yeah.
All right. So when the EEG is done, there are two ways to get information out of it. One is to come and stare at the screen at the bedside and right. stroke your chin and say, huh, oh. And then the other is to wait until somebody much smarter than you looks at the findings and writes something down in the chart. We'll start with the first one. And in the interest of time, we'll just stipulate that everyone knows that the EEG produces a bunch of different strips showing electrical activity in different parts of the skull and renders them as kind of, you know, activity over time. Is there, this is just a straightforward question, is there anything that you think it is reasonable and useful and achievable for people who don't know how to read EEGs to interpret at the bedside?
For sure.
What is
for
it?
For sure. Okay, so really, really basics. First, you need to actually see what you're looking at. And I know that that's a little bit, this, I promise, is the only technical thing that I'm going to say, because otherwise, you won't be able to, you know, garbage in, garbage out, right? So you look at this, you look at the page. What your first thing that you need to drift is the settings, right? So are you filtering correctly? So just remember, LFF is 1, high HFF is 70. This is what you were filtering out. So you're filtering out anything below 1 hertz and greater than 70 hertz, okay? High frequency filter, low frequency filter. And then you're going to notice the notch, if it is off or on. If it is in the United States, if it is on, it's going to be 60 hertz. If it is Europe, it is going to be 50 hertz, or it can be off. And then you're just, this is the electrical noise, right? So so just know that. And then you are going to look at the page, and there are going to be vertical darker lines. Those, the darker ones, are the 1 second. To know whether or not it is calibrated enough, it should be about 3 centimeters, like about your thumb, okay, in between those. Okay, now that you look at this, it's like, okay, now I know what I am going to look at.
And anyone who looks at EKGs probably is feeling like this sounds a little familiar.
Yeah, you know? I was going to say.
Right.
So far, it's very similar to EKGs.
Right. And then what we're going to change now, it's add laterality, okay? So we are anal, we are brain, right? So then we need to make sure what is right and is different than what it is left, and we need to make that stand out in a pattern. So that is odd numbers is left, even numbers is right. So
odd numbered leads are the left side of the head, even is on the right.
That's okay. Right. That's right. And then whatever is labeled as Z is in the middle.
Z is neither odd or even. It's right down the center.
That is okay. Exactly right. Okay. So now you establish what it is that you're looking at. Okay. It would be helpful to know what montage, but just to stay with me for a second, who gives a shit about the montage right now? All right. So then, right. The most important thing is that, do I see brainwaves?
Okay, so is there anything happening, or are they in asystole?
Yeah.
That's right, of the asystole of the brain. That's exact. That would be bad.
Yeah.
That would be really bad, right? But then if it is an asystole of the brain and the patient is awake, something's wrong with your recording, right? It is just, you know.
And like asystole of the heart, it's not that usually a complete flat line. It's just usually very, very flat. I mean, there's a little bit of waviness sometimes, but
there is the PEA of the brain. Yeah. So, but it can be flat, and most often than not, it is flat. But it is actually sometimes easier to just come back from it, depending on what it is that got into flatness. I mean, we can put you flat and bring you back, okay. Just with meds.
So the first thing people can easily appreciate is just a totally like really super suppressed flat EEG, and there may be a differential for that, but that at least is recognizable. If you
that's
didn't
right.
sedate that patient or something, then that's a brain that's not doing much for some medical reason.
That's right. And then you're going to look, and then you're going to look at the next thing that I would look is that, is there any thing that if I sit on it is going to hurt my butt? How pointy things are, you know, like how really, and if it can be really, really pointy, and then if it is pointy and someone is twitching, could be muscle. That's the highest pointy thing there is. That is going to be muscle. And then it becomes complicated how to tease apart. But if not, then it's safe to at least be worried that that is a discharge. A discharge is a wave that you don't believe it's part of the symphony. Okay? So it is there as an intruder. It is a disruptor.
Like somebody coughing at the symphony.
That's right. Somebody exactly. Right? And then you go and say, like, okay, is this happen repeatedly, like it's a repeatedly? If so, do I have an interval between them or not? Okay. So if it is repetitive, then it could be a rhythmic or periodic pattern if I have six of the same one. And if I have an interval of whatever it is, of flatness or normal wave breaks or whatever it is in between those discharges, then it is a periodic discharge.
It's meaning they're happening at a regular time interval from each other.
So for regular or nearly regular, that means that there's less than 50% of variation on the interdischarge intervals. So that is a definition of periodic discharge. That's right. So it has to be, it's about the same. Right? Because, of course, the pattern can speed up and slow down, and the frequency for us is about in hertz, right? So then we talked about those vertical dark lines. So in hertz is how many of those waveforms do I fit in between those lines? That is cycles per second. That is hertz.
So regular discharges are more likely to be important than just occasional sporadic ones, the PVCs of the brain.
The PVCs of the brain. That's absolutely right. Exactly. But then, you know, it is that situation that, you know, every time that you have a PVC, you're rolling the dice for an R&D, right? So then if you are actually looking at that and they are happening with a higher frequency, you know, are they going to organize? Okay. And then it is the organization, not the pointiness. And I think we can hammer this down. It is something that it is helpful for the critical care community. People get excited on how pointy something is, okay, or how nasty looking that is. I am much more excited about how that is becoming organized into wanting to do something else and going their own way. It's almost like the coughing guy, you know, was actually spreading COVID and everybody at the same time start coughing again, you know? If it is a super spreader, you know, you're like, yo, you know, you're ruining the whole thing.
Yeah. Or the PVCs on your telly, is it just an occasional PVC or are they leading to longer runs of VTAC or something like that? And now he's had three or four beats and now he's having like 10 beat runs of VTAC. Or is it just here and there, there's a PVC and that's it?
That's right. But then in the organization into the nearly regular intervals that we were talking about, even if it is abundant, it is more than one per page, right? So even when it is abundant, if they don't organize, when they are repeating in a pattern that we can call regular, then I think it is perhaps more reassuring than I am seeing this brain organizing into something that can or is getting close. It's almost like, okay, so let's agree that the fire is a seizure, you know, and then you are just having like the ambers. I would then interpret this as the amber because then you just go like,
right,
and then it can catch.
But if
fire
if you
quickly.
See a bunch of them and none of them became anything else, it's less likely that they're going to.
Less likely, less likely, yeah. Then if they organize, but it is more likely that someone that had none of them.
Then if there was nothing, yeah. Now these could either be in all of your leads or some, depending on if it's more focal or...
That's right. And now I am going to, you know, say something unpopular. I am much more concerned for focal, you know, for truly organizing into seizures when I see them focal, because that it is telling me, particularly if it is in the temporal region, like an area that I see something else, like a rhythmic delta activity focal to the temporal lobe. Now, this person is more likely to seize than if I see generalized, because we have talked about, and I think it's a raising awareness in the critical care community that a lot of toxic metabolic insults can manifest as epileptiform discharges, generalized epileptiform discharges, or even organized and generalized periodic discharges, the GPDs, regardless of their morphology with triphasic or not. So some, and those can still organize. I don't want us all to dismiss those generalized periodic discharges or generalized discharges into something. It's never going to be a seizure. Because if it speeds up greater than 2.5 hertz, it may still be a seizure. I have the perhaps less popular opinion that not everything that it is a seizure needs to be treated with an anti-seizure medication. If you can afford removing or controlling or you know, resolving the toxic metabolic insult. Like drugs, you can always add. Like I have this philosophy, you can always add drugs. So for like the cefepime toxicity or the liver toxicity that you are actually seeing a lot of discharges that are generalized, they're not really obviously unequivocally ictal, meaning not really surpassing 2.5 hertz. I am more, you know, let's just say that the maxima of the iatrogenesis, how is full of great intention, deeply resonates with me. And throwing anti-seizure medication one after another, it's not necessarily the answer for those discharges. So when going back to close the loop, when I see focal, I think it is more likely that it is going to end up having a higher risk for a discrete evolving seizures than something that is generalized that may just stay on that continuum of annoyance that you feel like, ugh, I'm stuck, I cannot disconnect. And at the same time, I don't want to keep staring at this.
Okay. So for those of us who are just wandering by, look at the screen. If you're like a flat-looking brain, that is something you can probably appreciate.
Call someone.
If there are some kind of sharp, pointy discharges, then it may just be artifact from muscular twitching or movement. In that case, it may be a little hard to know. But if you don't really think that's happening, then you could ask, is it everywhere or just some leads? Are they recurrent and repetitive at somewhat regular intervals? That's probably more likely to be important to you. And then beyond that, it's probably going to be more of an expert question. But those are at least reasonable questions to ask. Stuff that is not super pointy is probably not going to be a big concern. And sort of, okay.
Unless they organize.
Anything can organize.
They are repetitive. Okay. It doesn't matter how blunt it is. Then the problem is the organization, okay. Right? They are like getting more into the camp of let's bang against the symphony.
Okay. All right, so the second question, of course, is somebody has read it, and now we have to read their read, and then I need someone to interpret the interpretation. So I think most of us, the question we're asking is this person having seizures or seizure-y stuff? And really what we're asking is, should I add or escalate seizure therapy, whether that's anti-seizure medications or sedatives or something like that, or I don't need that, or I could even de-escalate things that I'm on. And the problem is that it seems like there's a very wide spectrum of stuff that's sort of vaguely epileptic. It's this sort of broad continuum of how worrisome or not it is, which we've kind of been hitting on a little bit. And it's not clear to me, and perhaps not clear to anybody, at what point you should treat something or not. And it sounds like there's a lot of judgment call here. Are there any clear rules? And I'll give the obvious one. If someone reads it and says, there are like continuous active seizures, I'm going to assume we probably have to treat that. Or if they see nothing that is at all, like this is a totally normal brain, then they're good. But within that realm, is there anything that is pretty clearly requires, you know, seizure treatment or does not?
A gazillion of things going on in my
head. It's all art,
now.
Brian. You have to wave your hands for a long time and then.
Here's what I would say. So there are no, like, so first, if it is non-convulsive, right? We do not acknowledge that we do not have guidelines for that. Do not use guidelines, recommendation for generalized convulsive status epilepticus to non-convulsive status epilepticus.
So it's clearer what to do when there is clinical seizure. And
clinical generalized.
Generalized. And that's probably worse. Is that fair to say? Like
yeah.
if
oh,
they
yeah.
are convulsive.
Oh, yeah. yeah. Oh, yeah. They can die. Yeah. Okay. So then for non-convulsive, they just know that you have time. It is non-convulsive. Doesn't matter how bad the read is. You have time. You have time. Okay.
So all people know who, you know, untreated seizures long enough can cause brain damage and stuff. That's more convulsive seizures. I mean, I'm not saying leave them in non-convulsive status, but it's not as time sensitive an emergency.
Right. And then the more areas of the brain involved, the more likely that those seizures are clinically relevant. And clinically relevant is they are more likely to be potentially a contributor to the neurological status of that patient, right? Like we talked about it, oh, if it is, you know, what we... like generalized, like involving both sides of the brain, if it is not generalized, involving both sides of the brain, it's unlikely that it's causing this comatose state, right? Or whatever it is. So yes. So, you know, like you have to ask the question, where is the seizure and when it spreads, how much of the brain is actually involving. And if it is bilateral, it's more likely to be contributing to that neurological status. Now, it can be focal on the left side and the patient is not following commands, and that is clinically relevant too, right? Because it just so happened to be catching a non-motor eloquent area of the brain. Does that make sense? Yeah. So then it can be clinically relevant because oftentimes you care about their following commands prior to extubation most of the times. I think that non-neuro ICU units care about that much more than we do because, you know. But then, you know, it can impact your decisions down the road, I would say.
Sounds like this is less like ACLS and more like oncology. It's like,
right. Yeah.
Where is it? How big is it? How likely do I think it's going to spread? What are the harms of treatment?
Brendan, if you're not dealing with tonic seizures, you know, it's the only neurological thing that makes me lose my shit. You know, that is the perfect storm and spiral of death. You know, you cannot ventilate, you cannot oxygenate. They are like becoming acidotic by the second to a pH of 6 point something with both carbonarcosis and the lactate rising, right? Because it is the tonic component that truly rises the lactate. So other than that, that is the chest, the hands on the chest, right? Tonic seizure is the hand on the chest, right? So you actually have to do something, no matter what it is, just to stop that shit, right? So everything else, you can walk towards that room, you know, particularly
and
if it is non-convulsive.
And talk to a neurologist, basically. I mean, this is all going to come down to a real judgment call.
And then if the neurologist asks you to do phosphenytoin and you just feel empowered to say you are not going to kill my patient with the most cardiotoxic drug that you have access to, brain doctor, no. So then I feel just empowered for that and then say, let's talk about other options. Okay, so I think that is going to also be a rule of thumb. If you want to be trigger happy with the levetiracetam, oh, go for it. Who cares? You know, if they're going to be agitated, you know, sure, agitated is better than unresponsive, yeah? So then that is fine. Having said that, there are a bunch of little old ladies and gentlemen that are, like, we talk about, like, anesthesia by Keppra, right? Like, you start de-escalating this ridiculous dose of Keppra and they start waking up. So, of course, even levetiracetam can be sedating. But for those that are, like, IV, I would say very benign drug. Lacosamide, if your EKG is okay, you're not dealing with like annoyingly refractory rapid AFib or significant bradycardia, it is a relatively benign medication that you feel that you have to do something, it's okay to reach out for that. But phosphenytoin, please don't do it.
Well, I find this very liberating because it sounds like it's kind of hard to get it right, but it's also hard to get it really wrong. So,
super hard to get it wrong.
Now, we're not talking about the person who is like convulsing for the past 10 minutes and like you got to give them benzos and all that stuff. We're talking
Please.
About the,
yes.
the much more subacute person who's, right. yeah, okay, all right.
You finally got access to the EEG, right? So the patient is in that neurological state for 4 days. You finally got it on and it is non-convulsive seizures. Or non-convulsive status. Come on. It was probably like that for a few days.
Yeah, it's not
you know?
Great. But
you have time to make a decision that has the least amount of iatrogenesis associated with that.
Okay. Brian, what else do we have?
Well, I don't know. I think this has been really great.
I'm getting that all epileptology is made up.
Yeah. yeah.
Well, it is actually. It's a lot of it is arbitrary. Why 6 cycles over 2 cycles?
The
you
best
know,
reason
to
do
EEGs
is
up.
Not for seizures.
Yeah.
And
for sure.
And you don't have access to an EEG anyway, gentle listener, so it doesn't matter. Yeah.
So the other thing that I would say that it is important is a seizure can look like anything on EEG. So if you have a clinical correlate that it is very stereotypic with whatever it is that is on EEG, that is a seizure, pointy or not, duration or not. So electroclinical seizure can look like anything. So then the periodic discharges, if they are really with every repetitive discharge, you are seeing a twitch, that is an electroclinical seizure. So that is another thing that it is a lot of misinterpretation. Oh, it's not a seizure because it's not greater than 2.5 hertz or discrete evolving. And then before we close, I think it's important to just address the continuum, right? And the icto-intericto continuum, so that you're going to see that a lot in your impressions. I just want the gentle reader to understand that what that actually means is that it does not meet the arbitrary and yes, made up boundary of greater than 2.5 hertz for unequivocal status epilepticus, but it is bad enough that could be if you have a clinical status that could be a reflection of that, like meaning like a degree of acute encephalopathy that is under not otherwise explained. So then what that means, when you see icto-intericto continuum on EEG, it is not unequivocal status, but it could be. And therefore, you should consider a loading dose of an anti-seizure medication as a therapeutic trial. And then if you have a clinical improvement and an EEG improvement, that was electroclinical status epilepticus. So that's why it is important not to try to do the therapeutic trial, despite whatever has been published in the literature. So this is me dissenting with what it is published. Not to do with benzos, right? Because the benzo will make your EEG better, but it may potentially cloud your ability to see a clinical improvement. So I favor a loading dose of an anti-seizure medication that has a faster time to peak brain concentrations, so then at least you can kind of have a time-sensitive sort of, or time-related, time-bound, if you will, evaluation. So brivaracetam is about 5 minutes. Valproic acid is about 5 to 10 minutes. Levetiracetam is 90 minutes. If you're going to use levetiracetam, so just be mindful that time to peak brain concentrations is 90 minutes. Fosphenytoin, don't do it. But if you are going to do it, then it is about 60 minutes and do it slow, please. Do not do it. If you're going to do it slow. Stop killing with fosphenytoin. All right.
So ictal-interictal is like, we don't know, tiebreaker is the clinical picture. If you think there could be a clinical impact of this, you test them with an anti-seizure drug and you see the effect on their clinical status as well as on the EEG. But otherwise, that's the PEA. It's the electrical activity could be bad or good. You have to see what the patient is doing. Is there?
I mean, it's not necessarily good.
It's not.
Right?
I mean, it's not normal.
It
sure, it's not normal sinus or whatever.
The symphony. But
it's VTEC. It could have a pulse or not.
Right. It could have a pulse or not. That's a good one. That's a good one.
Okay.
Yeah. That's a good one.
All right. Well, I think this has actually been helpful. Which is more than I could say about a lot of EEGs. So,
I'm glad.
All right, we'll let you go. Thanks for this, and I think this has actually been a big help for a lot of those who are not in the neuro world. We'll just remind everyone, this is only our own opinions. You've heard some clear dissents from the guidelines already, and we're not representing our institutions or anybody else. It's just some general education. But we will talk to you guys next time.
Thank you. And then if there are any questions that come in the audience, please, please feel free to just send my way. And I will love to answer any questions. If you have anything about EEG and you want to talk more, oh my God, just reach out.